and believed she was very likely still alive. Her body was never found. Now we know why. We also know that strands of Melody's hair were found in 2010 that showed evidence of arsenic poisoning, and blood was found, and blowflies. Sounds like someone went to a lot of trouble to fake her murder. If I were you, Bonnie, I'd be asking who'd want to pretend a little girl was dead if she wasn't, and why.
Bonnie Juno.
I feel like I ought to be offering you a job on our show, Taryn.
Taryn Fry.
No, thank you. Why aren't the FBI here yet? Has anyone called them?
Bonnie Juno.
Thank you for your insights, Taryn. Now, we found that online picture of Melody, aged.
Taryn Fry.
Wait a second, I'm not done yet.
Bonnie Juno.
Hey, Taryn, this is my show. When you have a legal show of your own...
Taryn Fry.
Kara's not the only one who's disappeared. Rihanna Briggs, the receptionist who sent her to the wrong room her first night here, she's missing too. I'm certain someone's taken them both. Kara found a piece of paper in the spa with Kara Burrows, is she safe, written on it. Why aren't you mentioning that? Also, what about the credit card Robert and Hope Katz used to reserve their room? Has that been traced? If not, why not?
Bonnie Juno.
Whoa, slow down, lady.
I've heard nothing yet about the Katz credit card, but that's a very good question, and I'll ask Detective Sanders in a moment. Now, before you get too carried away, Taryn, Rihanna Briggs is not missing. She left work suddenly after her boss criticized her. She left his office in tears and at speed, and she's probably at home licking her wounds.
Taryn Fry.
I don't think she...
Bonnie Juno.
Thank you, Taryn Fry. What a character, ladies and gentlemen. Didn't you love her? We'll be back with you after a short break, so stay tuned.
Chapter 12. October 14th, 2017. The sound of jangling keys wakes me with a start. For a fraction of a second, I'm in my bed at home with Patrick snoring next to me and the ceiling shaking as the kids stomp around on the floor above, getting ready for school. Another ordinary day. Then it hits me. Where I am, where I'm not, where I might never be again. Another day in this nightmare. Another morning in hell. By the time the trailer door opens, my mind has plunged through every feeling I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. Except my abductor. I'd wish all bad things on him. He's the first worst enemy I've ever had. I don't blame him less because none of this was his idea. I blame him more. This morning he has a tray in his hand. I got you another sausage and bacon sandwich. Made sure the bacon was crispy, and coffee and juice. Pink grapefruit this time for a change. You like grapefruit? Kara? You okay?
I don't answer. What's the point? He puts a tray down on the kitchen counter. I wait for him to start his usual routine. Take the gun out of the drawer, then come over and untie me. Instead he turns and starts walking back to the door. Is he leaving? How can I eat or drink if he doesn't untie me?
Wait, I say. Don't worry, I'm not going anywhere. I'm getting something else. Can't carry everything in all at once.
I close my eyes and swallow hard as I try to imagine what something else might be. Another weapon? A knife? When he returns, he's holding a thick pile of papers and a smaller, flat object with a pattern of hexagons on it, like patchwork. Green with white dots on one patch, solid pink on another. As he comes closer, I see that the papers aren't loose but bound, though not properly, not with a spine like a book. See-through, plastic covers.
You need to read this,
he says, putting it down beside me. What is it? There's nothing where I'd expect the author and title to be, only a blank white front page beneath the plastic.
A book. Read it.
Something about his expression makes me brave enough to ask. Are there answers in it?
Yes, there are.
He allows a smile that was playing around his mouth to show itself. I try to copy it, reflect it back to him. He thinks he's bought me a treat.
What you said yesterday. You were right. I figured you deserved to know some stuff, and it wouldn't do any harm. Like you said.
And Melody agreed? A thought I had before I fell asleep last night comes back to me. She's 14 now, but when her murder was faked, she was only 7. There's no way a 7-year-old could formulate and carry out a plan like that. Was Gungai in charge at first and then, gradually, as she got older, Melody took over? Did she figure out a way to manipulate him over the years so that he finally ceded all power to her? Could a 12, 13, 14-year-old do that? If she can do it, maybe I can too.
I want this time you spend here to be as bearable for you as possible, Kara. Look what else I've got.
He holds up the flat thing. It's a laptop computer in a patterned case. That's what the patchwork thing is. No way he'd choose that pattern. A 14-year-old girl would choose it, though. My throat tightens. The computer's a step too far. Why is he giving me so much of what I want all of a sudden? It makes me feel uneasy. Are you going to let me send a message to my family? I ask. Hearing myself say the words makes me feel faint with hope, dizzy with terror. If he says no...
Breakfast and bathroom first. Then we'll talk.
It seems to take forever, but finally it's over, and Gungai sits beside me on the sofa. Puts the gun down on his other side. There's no way I could lunge and reach around him to get it. It's too far.
Which first? He asks. Do you want to read a bit of the book first, or watch something you might find interesting on the laptop?
Both. Both now. I shrug helplessly.
Okay, let's start with this, then.
He opens a laptop and types in a password. I can't see what it is. He typed it too fast.
I've got a video to show you, but first I want you to read something. A public statement Jeff and Christy Revel made after Melody's parents were charged with her murder. Take your time to read it. There's no hurry.
Because I'm going to be locked in here till I die? How can I concentrate? How can I read and take in the words, wondering if one day soon he's going to kill me?
He says, Christy and Jeff remain loyal to Annette and Naldo Chapa till the end. As you'll see.
There's a reference number at the top of the screen that's something to do with Philadelphia Police. A date, a title. Statement made by Christy and Jeff Revel. And their address. I skim over all this and start to read the statement itself.
We have been informed today by our lawyers that Annette and Naldo Chapa have been charged with the murder of their daughter Melody, and that we will face no charges relating to this matter. It is impossible to put into words the immense relief and gratitude we feel to have been finally exonerated. We both adored Melody and would never have dreamed of doing any harm to her. We loved her as if she were our own daughter. These past few months have been distressing and grueling for us, as our good names have been dragged through the dirt that is the court of uninformed public opinion. We have discovered that knowing yourself to be innocent of a crime is scant consolation when the whole world believes you are guilty. There is a very real, life-ruining sense in which guilt truly dwells in the eye of the beholder and is not merely the objective fact our justice system believes it to be. We are deeply grateful for the support of all those people who spoke up for us, and even those who did no more than point out that nothing had so far been proven against us, and to everybody out there who believed we were guilty of murder and continue to believe it, we say this, we do not hold it against you. If we had not known for certain that we were innocent, we too might have been convinced by the media and the online mob that we must be murderers. We understand that the harsh and widespread condemnation we received was a reflection of how much people cared about Melody, and for that love and care shown for her, we will always be grateful, even if we suffered as a result. We are and always will be grateful, also, for the support of Bonnie Juno and the Justice with Bonnie team. They argued for our innocence from day one, and we appreciate their efforts on our behalf. However, we cannot endorse or condone the punitive and accusatory approach that the same team has taken with regard to our neighbors and friends, Annette and Naldo Chapa. Annette and Naldo are now in the position that we were in not long ago. The whole country, it seems, believes they murdered Melody. There is much talk of evidence against them, as there was when we were suspected. We would ask that people reserve judgment and keep an open mind.
In our opinion, Annette and Naldo cannot have harmed Melody. Knowing them as we do, we cannot bring ourselves to believe they are guilty. We also know from our own experience that the same piece of solid evidence can be used as the basis for any number of made-up stories. And often the story that sounds the most likely on a superficial level, the one that's easiest to tell, is the only one that is heard, irrespective of the facts. Evidence, in this case as well as in a more general sense, only goes so far. We have no proof, but we believe in our hearts that Melody is still alive and out there somewhere. Her body has not been found, and so we cling to our hope that she is safe and well. Until she is found, until the person who stole her away from her life is caught and punished, we intend to stand by Annette and Naldo Chapa. We know that, for taking this position, we will be accused of disloyalty to and betrayal of Melody, and all we can do is restate our firm belief that her parents are innocent. The real betrayal of Melody would be to accept, as the truth, what feels to us like a lie, and allow the truly guilty party in this matter to escape the consequences of his or her heinous actions.
Did Christy and Jeff Revel change their mind after Annette and Naldo were convicted of Melody's murder? I ask.
Nope.
So, are the four of them still friends? Is that a stupid question? Do convicted murderers who've been imprisoned for life have friends? I suppose some of them must. Friendships conducted by letter, occasional meetings across a table in a room full of other murderers and their loved ones.
No. My kidnapper's voice hardens. That's Annette and Naldo's doing, not Jeff and Christie's. Won't let them visit. Nothing.
One thing seems clear. He's pro-Revels, anti-Chapa's. Can I see the book now? I ask him. He nods and hands it to me. I open it and turn to the first page with writing on it. It starts without a chapter heading or number or anything. For the longest time, I thought my sister Emery was the lucky one. Sometimes I still feel that way. She died before they could kill her. No life at all is better than a life spent waiting to die.
Pretty was glad to be out of Swallowtail's spa complex. He'd known such places existed, dropped Althea off at one once for a friend's birthday celebration, but seeing it from the inside was something else. It made him think of a religious cult, blissed out people walking around in identical white robes, walking too slowly, all with the same blank eyes and bland smiles. He had seen only one interesting facial expression the whole time he'd been there. A young woman had looked at him, almost aggressively. Perhaps he'd broken a spa rule. The staff didn't wear the white robes. They had a different uniform. Baggy pants, tunic, name badge. As far as Pretty could tell, they'd all told him the truth. None of them had seen Kara Burrows in the spa more recently than her husband, Patrick, had last seen her. Pretty had been allowed to look at the contents of the silver pot in the crystal grotto. He'd found many dubious expressions of angst and also the bit of paper Taryn Fry had talked about with Kara Burrows, is she safe, written on it. Beneath those words, someone, maybe Kara herself, but Pretty knew better than to assume, had written a reply to the effect that she did not feel safe, having read the above. That piece of paper was now in Pretty's pocket. As he'd slipped it into an evidence bag, he'd caught himself wondering, could it be true? Could Melody be alive? Just take the note to Sanders. He can do the wondering. Pretty was about to climb aboard his club car when he heard a raised voice, female. Hey, cop! He turned. The girl with the aggressive expression was marching toward him, barefoot, still in her white robe. Out here she looked a lot younger, not much more than 16 or 17. Are you here to find Melody Chapa? She asked.
Melody Chapa was murdered 7 years ago,
Pretty said.
You don't sound sure about that.
Don't I?
No, you don't. Don't sound like you care either. Have you found Kara yet?
You know Kara Burrows?
The girl nodded.
Kind of.
What's your name?
Jazelia Fry, Zelly, colloquially.
colloquially. Hold on, Fry?
Are you the daughter of Taryn Fry?
Yeah, shoot me. It'd be the kindest thing. Pretty couldn't help smiling.
Your mother's been helping us.
No, she hasn't. That's why I'm out here in a bathrobe. She's lying to you.
What lie?
She told you that she saw Melody after Kara Burrows disappeared. She did not see Melody.
How do you know?
She told me. Boasted about it. How the two jackass cops had totally fallen for it.
Your mother boasted about lying to the police to you, her daughter?
Yep. And much as I don't want to be, like, an informer, Kara and Rihanna Briggs are missing, so I thought I'd better say something in case it matters. Pretty wondered if this was some sort of joke.
So when your mom told us she'd seen Melanie Chapa alive here at the resort yesterday, that wasn't true?
No. The girl seemed genuine enough.
Why'd she lie?
According to her or according to me? Personally, I think she can't bear for there to be a drama unless she's got a main part. But that's not what she'd say. She'd say she did it to make sure you'd take the story seriously about Melody being alive. With Kara gone and that crazy old lady as the only other witness, she feared you might not, so she decided to step up.
Lying's not going to help us find Kara Burrows,
said Pretty. I know that. She disagrees. Why do you think I'm telling you? Assuming you think at all. Pretty let the insult pass. Also, just before I came to the spa, I walked into the bathroom of our hotel room, and she was sitting fully dressed on the side of the bath. She saw me and stuffed something up her shirt sleeve, then completely denied it, even though I'd seen her and she knew it.
What sort of something?
Paper, that's all I could see, said Zelly. Pretty nodded.
Well, thanks for telling me.
Are you going to speak to her?
I suppose so. I'll keep your name out of it.
Don't bother. It's pointless. Who else could have told you? Zelly shook her head in disgust. You suppose so? Are you just pretending to be a cop? You don't seem much like a real one to me. Pretty cursed under his breath as she walked away.
Why have you stopped reading? Asks my kidnapper. Did you expect me to read it all in one go? Immediately. You don't find it interesting? No, it's just that I have such a busy schedule. First staring down the barrel of the gun you're pointing at me, then praying I'll think of a way to get out of here, then wishing you dead. I'd like to hear your thoughts, when you're ready to share them, he says. Well, it's clearly supposed to be written by Melody Chapa. He tenses. He didn't like me saying that. Was I not meant to work it out? It's so obvious. Supposed to be? I can hear in his voice that he's scared of the answer I'm going to give him. There's no way this was written by a 14-year-old. Why do you say that? It's too polished. Sentence by sentence, it's too neat and flowing. I have a very intelligent, well-read 13-year-old daughter, but she doesn't write like a published book by an adult. Neither did anyone I worked with when I was education officer for a charity and working with teenagers and reading their stuff every day. 14's plenty old enough to write well. Mozart did some of his best work when he was under 5, didn't he? No. He didn't? My captor frowns. I heard he did. I think he wrote Twinkle Twinkle Little Star when he was a child, but I'm not sure you can call that his best work. I'm not actually sure he wrote it. It might be one of those things everyone thinks is true but isn't, like Melody being dead. Are you going to start being unpleasant? Is that what you think I deserve? He's serious. It makes me want to fight for my version of reality, the true version. You mean because you haven't beaten me or starved me or killed me yet, you've brought me bacon sandwiches, so I should be grateful? Here's a tip to help you with the rest of your life. No one you knock out with chloroform, tie up with ropes, and lock in a trailer against their will is ever going to be grateful to you. There, I've just saved you a lifetime of disappointment. He sucks in his lips. The skin around his mouth turns white. I shouldn't have said it. I need a strategy, not to flip back and forth between placating him one minute and attacking him the next. What charity? He asks quietly. What? You said you used to work for a charity. Why does that matter? doesn't, he shrugs. Just making conversation.
Please don't feel you have to. I don't mean to sound sarcastic, and I hope I don't. There's no point in antagonizing him. I just don't want to have to talk to him.
I'm not doing it out of a sense of obligation, he says. If things were different, you and I might be friends. Don't you feel that, Kara?
We could still be friends, I say expressionlessly. On one condition. You let me go. Right now. If you do that, I can forgive everything that's happened so far. Hearing my cold, rigid voice, I want to cry. I know I'm handling this all wrong. Not that there's a right way to react when kidnapped, but I ought to have a carefully thought-out plan. I should decide how to act around him, how to talk to him, and then stick to it. But my fear and anger make it almost impossible to pretend, to stop myself from blurting out what's inside my head at any given time. A mix of disappointment and disgust contorts his face.
Kara.
It's not hard, I talk over him. You care about Melody, clearly. All you need to do is care as much about me. I have a husband and children. She doesn't. You want to get to know me better? All right. I was education officer for a charity called Heartlight. My husband's name is Patrick. He runs a company that frames sports memorabilia. My kids are Jess and Ollie. I gave up my job when I had Jess, and suddenly my family was all that mattered to me. But then I got pregnant again by accident and discovered that I was the only one who cared about our family. The rest of them said, "New baby, no thanks." That's when I wondered for the first time if I'd been wrong to give up my career for a family that, it turns out, no one gives a shit about apart from me. Why am I saying this? I sound as if I hate Patrick and the kids, when all I want is to get back to them. Still, I can't stop. I take a ragged breath and say, I mean, they care about themselves, sure, but not about the family as a whole. Or else, they wouldn't be so keen for me to get rid of the newest member of it, this new baby. That's how I ended up in Arizona, alone. I couldn't look at them. Couldn't risk opening my mouth in their presence in case I started screaming things at them that I could never take back. So I upped and left, treated myself to a holiday in Arizona. Do you feel you know me better now? Are we friends? Do I sound to you like someone who deserves to have a life, as much as Melody Charper does? He turns his head away at the mention of her name, as if I've said something offensive. For minutes he doesn't speak. Then he reaches for the computer, saying,
I want you to see this video.
He mentioned a video before, and he brought the book. For some reason, there are things he wants me to know or to believe, so that I'll think well of him when he finally releases me, or so that I'll think well of him before I die. If I withhold my good opinion and make it clear I'm still unconvinced, will I live longer? I concentrate all my energy on not punching him in the head while he taps on the keyboard.
Here we go, he says.
It's on YouTube. A woman and a man on a stage with dusty wooden floorboards. Black, shiny material behind them. The man sitting on a high-backed wooden chair facing the camera, wearing a check shirt and brown corduroy trousers. Bold on top, metal-rimmed square glasses, tufts of brown hair on the sides of his head. A beard that's brown at the sides, auburn in the middle. He looks about 50. Ollie would say he looks like a nerd. The woman's short, not much taller than the chair the man's sitting on, with wavy golden brown hair in a ponytail. She looks to be in her 40s. Her face, particularly her mouth, makes me think of a duck. She's walking slowly around the man. In her hand is a paintbrush with green paint on its tip. After circling him twice, she stops, stares at the camera and says, "The great image has no form." The man, also straight to camera, repeats the line,
"The great image has no form."
"Everything is a continuum," says the woman.
"There are no objects, only non-objects," says the man.
"Huh? Art cannot be separated from reality."
Him. "Art is not a representation of reality."
Both of them together. "Art is reality, and reality is art." The woman uses her brush to paint the word "the" on the man's forehead, then passes it to him. He gets up out of his chair, revealing himself to be considerably taller than her. Then he bends down and paints something on the stage. When he straightens up and stands back, the camera angle shifts to show what he's painted on the floorboards. Great image has no. The woman steps forward and the man paints the word form on her forehead. They hold hands and bow. That's it. Clip over. Christy and Jeff Revel? I ask. I read online that he's an art teacher, and she's an artist.
Yeah, that was Jeff and Christy. I wanted you to see that, so you'd know.
Know what?
That they could never hurt anyone. They're good people. Some of the best.
Did he watch a different clip from the one I saw? To me, the Revels seemed deranged. Anyone who makes a video of themselves painting green words on each other's foreheads, that doesn't say normal to me. Also, when the person vouching for you is a man who kidnaps women and holds them at gunpoint... Was it one of them who wrote the book? The Melody book? Jeff or Christy?
Why do you think that?
I notice you're not saying. Of course not. Melody wrote the book. I can't think who else it could be apart from Christy or Jeff Revel. I doubt it was you, and it's hardly going to be Annette and Naldo Chopper. The bit I've read so far doesn't show them in a good light.
Kara, Kara, he exhales slowly. When it comes to those two, there is no good light. If you doubt they deserve to be where they are, then I've got something else you need to see.
However terrible they were as parents, if Melody's alive, they shouldn't be serving life sentences for her murder. He's reaching for the laptop again.
See what you think once you've watched this. You'll see Annette and Naldo didn't lose any sleep over their missing daughter. Not a wink.
From Justice with Bonnie, August 27th, 2012. BJ. Welcome back to the show. We have with us in the studio computer forensics analyst Dr. Lucy Story. Welcome, Lucy.
L.S.
Thanks so much, Bonnie. It's great to be here. I'm the biggest fan of the show.
BJ.
That's so sweet of you. Well, we do our best here on Justice with Bonnie to help deliver justice to victims and their families. Although in this case, as you probably know, this show believes that the family of little Melody, her parents, Annette and Naldo Chapa, are the guilty parties.
L.S.
Bonnie, after what I've seen firsthand, I can't disagree with you. Though, obviously, that's for a jury to decide at some point in the future.
BJ.
I only wish I had the faith in juries that I once had. But Lucy, you're here today to tell us what you found when you did a forensic analysis of Annette Chapa's online activity during the period between when Melody went missing and when Annette and Naldo Chapa were charged with her murder. You performed this analysis yourself, didn't you?
L.S.
Yes, I did, at the request of the Philadelphia police.
BJ.
And what did you find?
L.S.
Melody disappeared and was reported missing on March 2nd, 2010. At first, as I'm sure most people are aware, the suspicions of the investigating detectives were focused on the next-door neighbors, Jeff and Christy Reville. The first time there was any indication of suspicion in the direction of Annette and Naldo was March 22nd, when you said, unambiguously, on this show that you suspected them, Bonnie.
BJ.
That's right. I'm proud to say that I wasn't afraid to speak up when everybody else was either too stupid or too scared to put their neck on the line. I could see it right away. Those parents knew where their daughter was because they'd put her there. But tell our viewers at home, Lucy, how is that date, March 22nd, relevant to what you found when you examined Annette Chapa's laptop?
L.S.
Okay, here's the thing. Between March 2nd, when Melody disappeared, and March 22nd, when you said live on this show that you believed Annette and Naldo Chapa were responsible for their daughter's disappearance, there was a pattern to Annette Chapa's internet use.
BJ.
And the relevant issue here is the times at which she used the internet, not so much what sites she visited, correct?
L.S.
Yes, though later the sites she visited become relevant, but I'll come to that in due course. So, during that period, March 2nd to March 22nd, Annette Chapa didn't work. She was at home, focused only on finding Melody. According to her, finding...
BJ.
Finding her dead, not alive. She seemed convinced little Melody was dead.
LS.
Exactly what I was about to say. Finding her body and her killer, and we have that from Annette's own mouth. So, during this period, March 2nd to March 22nd, Annette was online, not constantly, but regularly, with reasonable frequency all day and evening. Then, at around 11:30 at night, that'd be it. No more online activity. And then she'd be offline again until around 8:30 the next morning.
BJ.
And so a reasonable person would assume...
LS.
That she was asleep.
BJ.
Sure, I mean... Who wouldn't get an unbroken 9 hours sleep a night immediately after their daughter got abducted, right?
LS.
I suppose Annette Chapa might not have been asleep throughout those nights. I mean, she might have been lying awake sobbing, for all we know. And I can't comment on the psychology of it, Bonnie. That's not my area of expertise. I know Ingrid Allwood has said that misery, anxiety, depression, these things can lead a person to take refuge in sleep and even in some cases bring on a sort of narcolepsy. That's assuming Annette Chapa was asleep.
BJ.
At this point, I'm not willing to dignify any more of Allwood's nonsense with a response. But let me ask you this. Did you check the pattern of Annette Chapa's online activity before March 2nd, 2010?
LS.
Yes, I did. Pretty much the same. Though obviously Annette was working right up until the day Melody disappeared, and her online activity reflected that. But the pattern in the evenings was the same. 11:30, it looks as if she logged off and went to sleep.
BJ.
And then no more online activity at all until 8:30 the next morning?
LS.
No, when she was working, she woke up earlier. Her first login was typically 6:37.
BJ.
Which makes sense if she had to go into the office, but, Lucy, you agree with me that 11:30 p.m. to 7 a.m., changing to 11:30 p.m. to 8 a.m. after Melody disappeared, we're not seeing a radical upheaval to her routine here, are we?
LS.
No, it's more or less the same.
BJ.
Which is why a certain celebrity psychotherapist is talking out of her rear end. Whatever misery or depression Annette Chapa suffered after Melody disappeared, it didn't cause her to sleep all that much more than usual. Only an extra hour or so in the morning, and that was clearly because of not needing to get to the office. She sure had herself some lazy, leisurely mornings after murdering her daughter. I'd love to ask Ms. Allwood, I refuse to call her doctor, if she's ever before come across a mother whose beloved child goes missing and it barely affects her sleep patterns at all.
LS.
Bonnie, I'm not pretending to claim that I know the hours Annette Chapa slept or stayed awake in March 2010. The evidence I've gathered shows only when she was on and offline.
BJ.
I understand that, and people will draw the only conclusion that's plausible, that Annette Chapa did not lose any sleep over her missing daughter. On the contrary, she got an extra hour of shut-eye every day thereafter. Now, tell us, what changes after March 22nd? In regard to Annette's internet use?
LS.
From March 22nd, the pattern completely changes, Bonnie. I assume Annette must have grabbed a half hour of sleep here and there, but from March 22nd onward, there are no long 8 or 9 hour stretches when she was offline, and when I say none, I mean it. None.
BJ.
That is truly fascinating, isn't it?
LS.
It really is. There's not much of a pattern at all after March 22nd. Some nights, internet activity would stop at around 2 or 3 a.m. Other nights, it'd stop at 4 or 5. Once stopped, it might start again an hour and a half or 3 hours later. But what can be said with certainty is that, after March 22nd, Annette Chapa did not get another decent night's sleep. And it's particularly noteworthy that March 22nd through March 25th, she seems to have gotten no sleep at all.
BJ.
She was on the internet all night?
LS.
It appears so, yes.
BJ.
All right, so let me get this straight. Melody's disappearance didn't keep her mom awake nights, but it seems that my saying live on air that I thought she was guilty of sin did? Is that a reasonable conclusion to draw?
LS.
Well, Certainly, when I looked at Annette Chapa's internet activity between March 22nd and March 25th, I found that a lot of it was focused around you. In layman's terms, she thoroughly checked you out.
BJ.
And I guess that's not surprising. If someone went on America's favorite legal show and accused me of first-degree murder, I'd do a whole lot more than check them out. What's more surprising is what happened between March 22nd and September 28th, 2010, when Annette and Naldo Chapa were finally, thank the Lord in his mercy, charged with Little Melody's murder. Tell us about that.
L.S.
As I've said already, Annette Chapa did not get a solid night's sleep after March 22nd.
B.J.
So that's 6 months of no proper sleep. That's incredible. And also horribly telling, in my opinion. Look, I spoke up on March 22nd, sure, but no one listened. No one wanted to listen. The whole world was convinced Christy and Jeff Reville had abducted and killed poor Melody, and convinced I was wrong and dumb and vindictive to insist otherwise. The evidence back then seemed to point to the Revilles, and that didn't change until September 2nd, when I had Mallory Tondini on the show. So, why on earth didn't Annette Chapa calm down on, for example, April 2nd or 3rd, and think to herself, looks like no one's paying attention to that horrible Juno woman, I don't need to worry about her? Why didn't she start sleeping nights right around then?
L.S.
Obviously I can't answer that, Bonnie. I don't know what was going through her mind. I can tell you, though, that in her shoes, I'd have been petrified if I thought you suspected me of murder, and I don't think that fear'd be easy to lose. Everyone knows you're tenacious, that you care passionately about justice and you're unlikely to give up. Also that your specialty, and this show's specialty, is cases where the wrong person falls under suspicion while the right one's ignored.
BJ.
It's true that I can't abide detectives and DAs who take one look at a case and decide to play pin the guilt on the patsy. Well, there we have it, ladies and gentlemen. When it was only an insignificant little irritation like a missing daughter who might be dead, Annette Chapa still managed to get her regular 8 or 9 hours sleep every night. The moment she perceived her own well-being was at stake, that I suspected her and would do whatever I could to bring her to justice, suddenly she doesn't sleep so well anymore. Poor little lamb.
L.S.
I suppose it's possible to be a selfish, unloving mother and still not be a murderer, but...
B.J.
Oh, please.
L.S.
You know, Bonnie, I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, but I feel a little uncomfortable about the forthcoming trial and the charge of murder specifically when no body has been found. I wanted to ask you...
B.J.
No body, but plenty of blood, Lucy, and strands of Little Melody's hair showing clearly that she was poisoned with arsenic while alive, and what's known as coffin flies in two locations where Melody's blood was also found. The kind of flies you only get where there's a dead body. That's why, even without a body or a crime scene or eyewitnesses, a grand jury made the decision it did to put Annette and Naldo Chapa on trial for murder. It's only a shame the death penalty was taken off the table. Thank you, computer forensics analyst Dr. Lucy Story, for joining us. And we're back after the break, when we'll be joined by Naldo Chapa's former assistant, Julie Smithfield. We'll hear what it was like to work closely with Melody's father, and I'll be asking Miss Smithfield how she feels about Chapa's imminent trial for the murder of his daughter, and whether she can shed any light on the character of his wife and the nature of their marriage and family life.
Chapter 13, October 14th, 2017. So, Swallowtail, in addition to all its other assets, had a maze. Only a small one, Pretty had been told by Dane Williamson, but popular with guests nonetheless. It was known as the Meditation Maze on account of the guided meditation walks that took place within it on Tuesday and Thursday evenings and Sunday mornings.
"Don't worry about reaching the butterfly,"
Williamson had said with a grin as he'd waved off Pretty's club car.
"It's not the destination that counts, it's all about the journey."
Pretty had been on that journey, on foot, for nearly 40 minutes looking for Taryn Fry. No chauffeur-driven club cars in the maze, sadly. The green passageways were too narrow. Each one looked identical to the others. Every corner seemed to whisper, "Try me, try me. You haven't before, I might be the one." Pretty had discovered that the more a corner looked like a rock-solid option, the more likely it was to lead to a dead end. None of the bristly slabs of hedge had any distinguishing features. Wherever he was in the grid of green, the sun beat down on him. If he'd known he was going to be stuck in here this long, he'd have brought a hat. What the fuck was the point of a maze? And what did people do who never chanced upon the right route? Statistically, it stood to reason that that would occasionally happen. How did they get back? Once you'd found the center of the maze, was that it? Ordeal over? Was there a quick way out? Pretty wished he'd asked Dane Williamson Summer all of these questions before setting out. As he walked, he called out Taryn Fry's name and Kara Burrows's also. A maze would be the perfect place to hide out, as long as you had weatherproof clothing and supplies of food and water. If you heard footsteps getting nearer, you could easily move off in a different direction. Pretty hadn't told Williamson why he wanted to check out the maze. He wasn't normally secretive, but with Bonnie Juno and her crew hanging around, he felt inclined to keep things to himself for as long as he could. Truth be told, he didn't want anyone to know what he was doing until he himself knew. Did he care that Zelie Fry thought he was a jerk? Or was it that this wanting to know about Melody, about Kara Burrows, about Rihanna Briggs, was contagious? If so, where did that leave the resolution he'd made 8 months ago? If it was work, he wasn't supposed to care. He sure as hell didn't care for being lost in a maze with only the word of a swallowtail maid to go on. She said she'd seen Taryn Fry at the entrance to the maze an hour ago. The rest of her story was verging on the incredible. After another 10 minutes, Pretty decided to stop telling himself that any left or right turn in the distance looked promising.
"Mrs. Fry,"
he called out wearily.
"Taryn Fry, can you hear me?"
Hearing a scrambling sound, he stopped and called her name again. "Who is that?" A woman's voice answered. Nearby, American. Wherever she was close. Hallelujah.
"This is Detective Orwin Pretty. Is that Taryn Fry?"
No answer.
"Is it Rihanna Briggs?"
"Oh, please, you think Rihanna's hanging out in a maze? Is that your best theory? Why, just for kicks?"
"Ma'am, what's your name? Who am I speaking to?"
"It's me, Taryn. Hate to disappoint, but there's no girly get-together in full swing here. I'm alone."
"I need to talk to you."
"You are talking to me. If you want to see me while we talk, come find me at the center. You're almost there."
"Any idea how I get to you?"
An incredulous laugh from Taryn.
"Come on, you're right here. If I stick my finger through here, I can touch you."
Pretty scanned the foliage around him but saw no protruding fingers.
"Can't you see the butterfly? Large, hideous sculpture, wings poking up over the edge?"
"No. Going by the experience I've had so far, if I walk in what I think is the right direction, I'm going to end up farther away. Do you think you could come find me?"
She said something in response, but he couldn't hear it. From the tone, it sounded like a grumble. Then,
"Sure. Don't move."
Half a minute later, Taryn Fry appeared in front of him. "Come on," she said, beckoning.
"Where are we going?"
"Back to the butterfly. There are benches there and shade." Pretty wanted to get out of the maze, but he said nothing. A little while longer wouldn't kill him. Same as with the job. He'd get out soon enough, out of the police and out of this grid of green. The butterfly turned out to be a stone sculpture at the center of a large, round water feature that dribbled and spouted in several directions at once. Around this, in a small hexagonal courtyard paved with hexagonal stone slabs, were 5 benches with curved backs. Pretty and Taryn sat side by side on the only bench that wasn't in direct sunlight, under another sculpture, a shiny silver tree with a curved mirror trunk and wide flat leaves, providing much-needed shade. "The two-tailed swallowtail, state butterfly of Arizona." Taryn gestured toward the sculpture. "I'm from Kansas. We don't have a state butterfly. We do have a state insect, the western honeybee. But I mean, who wants some asshole insect that stings? I'd rather have a butterfly."
Pretty came straight to the point.
"Mrs. Fry, have you been impersonating a detective?"
"No."
"No? Are you sure?"
"You're using the wrong tense.
past continuous or pluperfect or whatever instead of perfect. I haven't been impersonating a detective. No, not for a prolonged period or on a regular basis. Now, if you were to ask me if I have ever in the recent past...
Did you impersonate an Arizona detective, yes or no?
Once, briefly, yes, and it's damned lucky for you that I did. Understanding that no contrition would be forthcoming, nor any fear of consequences displayed, Pretty moved on.
You used deception to gain access to room 324 by impersonating a police officer?
Yeah.
And now you're hiding in a maze?
Hiding? If I wanted to hide, you'd never have found me. I came here to think, not to hide.
Taryn giggled suddenly.
Want to know what's funny? The maid who let me in, she should have known I wasn't a cop. She'd seen me before. I could see her thinking, isn't that the lady from the room over there? A few days ago, she came in and tried to start cleaning too early, and I had to shoo her out. But, push come to shove, she nodded and let me in because I seemed so certain I was a detective. Just goes to show, huh? Lie with supreme confidence and idiots will believe you, even when the evidence of their own eyes contradicts what you're telling them. Pretty sensed she was watching him out of the corner of her eye.
I guess that's true,
he said eventually. You really don't care, do you? Smarmy Sanders only cares about getting onto the Bonnie Juno slander show, and you're either some kind of weird Buddhist or lacking a brain lobe. I might not have the badge, but I'm more of a detective than either of you. Who stopped a maid who just vacuumed up a truckload of potential evidence in room 324 and took the bag off of her? Not you or Sanders, and not Bonnie Juno either. You all think Kara's fine. She just ran away when her husband showed up, and it has nothing to do with the Melody Choppa mess. You're wrong. She's in danger. If you don't want to do anything about it, can you put me in touch with someone who might?
Pretty thought about Lynn Kirschmeyer. She'd be perfect. She was FBI Phoenix, and nothing would take the shine off Bryce Sanders' sunny temperament like her unexpected arrival on the scene. Trouble was, the last thing Pretty wanted was to be in touch with Lynn again, and that was Sanders' fault, like so much else. Lynn could easily have heard about Kara Burroughs' disappearance on Justice with Bonnie. That could be the official line if Pretty brought her in without getting the okay from Sanders first. Pretty knew Lynn would never tell Sanders she'd gotten the tip-off from him.
What did you find in room 324?
He asked Taryn Fry. Apart from the vacuum cleaner bag I took into evidence, nothing. Strong chance you'll find Melody's DNA in there if you can be bothered looking.
You didn't find a piece of paper, then? One that your daughter later caught you looking at in the bathroom, prompting you to stuff it up your sleeve?
Taryn Fry looked thrilled at the mention of her daughter. Zelly spoken to you?
According to her, you were lying when you said you saw Melody Choppa yourself. You only said it because you believe Kara Burroughs and Mrs. McNair saw Melody and you wanted to lend support to the idea that she's alive.
Taryn laughed and clapped her hands together.
Well, good for Zelly. I raised that girl right. She has a mind of her own.
Is what she told me true?
Taryn squinted at him. Then she made an irritated tutting noise and said, You know what? I'm going to trust you, and if you let me down, I'm going to make sure you regret it for the rest of your life. But as for Sanders and Bonnie Juno, I'll never trust them, so anything I say to you is confidential. You don't pass it on. Deal?
I'm not supposed to withhold information from Detective Sanders. He has seniority.
And yet you hate him so profoundly, said Taryn. Pretty felt the muscles in his face tighten. How did this woman know so much? I'm a florist, she answered his unasked question. Think about when people buy flowers, weddings, funerals, anniversaries. Buyers of flowers are emotional, and I see all the emotions, believe me. So now I recognize them, and when people try to hide them, too. It's not hard. The look on your face when you say Sanders's name and talk about how you have to defer to his authority? You're the guy buying an expensive wreath for the funeral of the man who married the only woman you ever loved, hoping that if you spend more than you can afford, no one will guess how much you're looking forward to dancing all over your rival's grave.
Taryn opened her bag, pulled out a folded sheet of paper, and handed it to Pretty.
Here.
He opened it up.
It was a scruffy but at the same time impressively detailed line drawing of a man, in pencil. Above the image,
someone had scrawled in childish handwriting, "Doodle da." The rest of the second word was blurred. Someone had spilled a dark substance on the paper or dropped it into something.
"What's this?"
It was in the trash from room 324, the piece of paper Zelly saw me stuffing up my sleeve. "That's coke all over it, and the word you can't read is dandy."
"How do you know that?"
"When Kara walked into that room on her first night here, with the man and the girl in it, she heard the girl say, 'I spilled coke on Poggy and doodled dandy.'" Pretty allowed his disbelief to show on his face.
"You've said nothing until now about doodled dandy."
"I know. I didn't mention it because I thought it was an unnecessary distraction. Poggy was the important part, and I didn't want to muddy the water. It doesn't matter. The point is, here's Doodle Dandy, and I found him in room 324's trash, which proves that's the room Kara was in where she met Melody Choppa, alias Hope Katz. I'd bet good money that Dandy's the name of the guy, Melody's chaperone, a.k.a. Robert Katz."
"Based on what?"
Pretty asked. "My Zelly's been taking an art class since we got here. They've done drawing, painting, mosaic making. Guess what they did first of all?"
"I can't."
"Doodling, which means this comes from art class, right? Kids have no imagination anymore. Their titles are all watercolor mom, spray paint dad. They're plastered all over the art studio walls. Except Zelly, she called her painting of me irreversible decline. Ha!" Huh?
"And you think doodled dandies meant literally a doodle of dandy?"
Pretty was skeptical.
"How many guys are named Dandy?"
"There only needs to be one," said Taryn impatiently. "Look for anyone associated with Melody with Dandy as a first name, last name, or nickname." Was that an order? To Pretty, Dandy sounded like a small child's mispronunciation of Daddy. But that was impossible if the girl who did the drawing was Melody Choppa. Her daddy was in jail. "Also, this means Melody was in that art class, at least for the doodling part," Taryn went on. "Zelly says lots of kids dropped out early once they saw how demanding it was going to be. Ask the teacher. I bet you'll find the name Hope Katz on that list. Also, I've been thinking about Rihanna Briggs."
"What about her?"
"Try to find her and talk to her. If you can't find her, investigate her. Without telling Sanders, Bonnie Juno, Dane Williamson, or anybody who might try and send you off in a different direction. I think that's how you'll find Kara via Rihanna." Taryn Fry laid her hand over her stomach. Gut feeling. Pretty said,
"I'm not clear whether you think Rihanna Briggs is in danger or if you're implying she's responsible for the disappearance of Kara Burrows."
"I'm not clear either. Luckily, there's a way to get clear when you're not. It's called investigation. It's called detective work. I suggest you give it a try." Taryn Fry stood up and walked purposefully across the courtyard like a woman who knew exactly where she was going.
Chapter 14, October 15th, 2017. The sound of the key turning, the door opening, scrape, click, creak. I've taught myself to keep still when I hear these familiar noises. They don't mean I'm going anywhere or that anything will change. It seems odd that I used to say to myself, "Stay calm, don't get your hopes up." This morning, after my fourth night in this god-awful place, there's no adrenaline rush, no pounding heart, nothing.
"Kara?"
I don't look up. What's the point of asking more questions, starting yet another conversation? He's never going to let me go. I've tried everything I can think of, everything apart from making him believe I've given up hope. I haven't. But one day I might have to, and if I do, this pretense, my practice run, will have gone some way toward preparing me for the worst.
"Kara, you okay? I brought you some breakfast. Delicious and nutritious. Seriously, this stuff's good for you. The baby, too. I was given strict orders, no more bacon and sausage."
This sets my heart going faster. Then I feel like a fool. Whoever wants me alive and healthy today might change their mind by tomorrow. Or maybe they only want to reassure me so that I'll be off my guard. This morning my kidnapper is bare-chested, wearing only jeans and Nikes. My throat closes up when I see those familiar swirls of dark chest hair. This is the second time I've seen him half-naked.
Last time it wasn't his fault, but this time it is. Last time I was sure it would never happen again. How dare he come in here like this, as if we're a happily cohabiting couple? It's no big deal to him. He won't even have thought about it. In his mind, he is dressed enough. Not in mine. He's holding a tray in his hands. There's a glass of orange juice and a plate with a white shapeless blob and a green shapeless blob on it. What is that? I say. Egg white omelette and wilted spinach. It looks disgusting. Like a grotesque parody of the eggs Florentine I had in my casita the other day. Before this happened. I can't bear to think about before. This is my life now, this trailer and a man I hate and wish dead. Can I have a bacon sandwich instead? I don't think I can eat that. Cara, this is really good for you. And the baby. I'd be sick if I tried to swallow it. Listen, you're not the only item on anybody's agenda. He snaps. Know what I mean? This is today's breakfast. Take it or leave it. I'm sorry. Do you have other women tied up in trailers all over Arizona? That would be a pretty extensive catering option. I can see that. Funny, he says, tight-lipped. I imagine that silently he's congratulating himself on his restraint. What's funny is that it turns out I can be viciously sarcastic and not care at all. Tears fill my eyes as it occurs to me that if I could have laid into Patrick in the same way even only once, I might not have felt the need to flee the country. And then none of this would be happening to me or to my family. No point wishing. You can't undo the past. Let's try to get along, shall we? Says the man in a sulky voice. We have until now, however difficult the circumstances.
I agree. Let's not spoil an enjoyable incarceration.
He puts the tray down on the table.
Why are you being like this all of a sudden?
I'm being like this because, given the options available to me, it's the only way I have to exercise my freedom. And if you couldn't work that out without my help, you can't be all that bright. If he's stupid and unimaginative, there has to be something I can do, some way I can outwit him. He takes a gun out of his back pocket, puts it down next to the tray, and helps me to sit up. I flinch as he unties my wrists and his skin touches mine.
Go ahead, exercise your freedom, he says. I won't take it personally.
My body needs exercise too, I say. After breakfast, can we go for a walk? With a gun, if that's the only way. Just anything. I need to move. Properly, not just walking little circles around this room.
Sorry. He picks up the gun and points it at me. You can't go outside. Too risky. Eat your food.
When will I be able to go out? Ever? You can't just keep me locked in here. I have to be allowed to go outside. Even prisoners are.
I'm sorry, Cara.
There's no knife or fork.
What? Oh, sorry.
He pulls a white plastic fork out of his pocket, the same one the gun came from, and throws it across to me. It lands on the tray. The omelette is still warm, though barely. And yet he carried it into the trailer uncovered, no plastic wrapping, no solid silver dome lid like a swallowtail to keep hot food hot. That has to mean... How did I not work this out sooner? He's got two trailers. I'm in one, and he sleeps in the other. With Melody, probably, like in the hotel room. I never hear the sound of a car before he comes in, so his trailer must be within walking distance. That's where he cooks my food, or maybe Melody cooks it. Maybe it's not a trailer, but an isolated house, and I'm somewhere on its land. I'm not sure if it helps me to know this, assuming I'm right. Still, it feels good to have even the tiniest bit more information. After a few mouthfuls of flavourless egg white and a few sips of orange juice, I have the energy for more conversation. Freshly squeezed, I say, nodding at the glass. Nice touch. If I ever get to rate this kidnapping on TripAdvisor, I'll give it 4 stars now instead of 3. He stares into the distance as if I haven't spoken. We have to work something out, I tell him. I need exercise. I need to get out of this small, enclosed space. So how about this? We wait till it's dark, middle of the night, and then you come and get me and we drive out to somewhere really isolated and just walk around for an hour or so. Then we come back. You can keep me tied up while you drive and have the gun on me the whole rest of the time while we're walking. I don't see any risk to that. Do you?
Let me think about it.
I want to scream. Keep calm, Cara. I close my eyes so as not to have to see the gun pointed at me, rising and dipping in his unsteady hand. I try to imagine myself somewhere else, not home,
That's too painful. I mustn't think about how it would feel to be home. Swallowtail. That big, beautiful blue swimming pool. Smooth, long strokes, one side to the other. Or maybe I'll yell, Marco Polo, at the top of my lungs, like the girl with the thick sausage braids. Wait. What was that? Something passed through my mind so quickly I missed it, like a ghost glimpsed in a mirror that's gone before you've turned round. Something to do with the girl with the braids.
Kara, eat. You won't have the strength to walk anywhere if you don't get some food inside you.
Walking. Running. I think of Lilith McNair. What I heard her say.
I saw her running. Melody, running. How come she can run all of a sudden? Can my cousin Isaac run? Let me tell you, he can't even walk.
Mrs. McNair's cousin Isaac, who died of lymphoma. Unless he didn't die. Nothing she said or wrote online made it clear he was dead. I just assumed it. It's equally possible he's still alive, but very sick. Yes, that would work. Putting that together with the girl in the swimming pool. Oh, God. Am I right? I so desperately want to be right. I could do something with this, but how can I know if it's true?
Kara,
I hear the click of the gun's safety catch. Whatever's showing on my face, it's worried my jailer. Good. Let him be scared. Let him be terrified in the way that only those who know they're doing something terribly wrong can be. The Marco Polo girl's sausage braids were flying around like two thick ropes all over the pool that day. No member of the resort staff batted an eyelid. Everyone, I saw in the swallowtail pools, had their hair uncovered. Which means there's no rule saying bathing caps must be worn. Yet in the room Rihanna sent me to by mistake, Melody's room, I saw one of those horrible rubber swimming caps. At least that's what I thought it was. Not exactly pink, not quite beige. Skin-coloured.
Kara, what's the matter? Is something wrong?
No one would wear one of those things by choice. Only someone incredibly precious about the condition of their hair, and I can't believe Melody Charper would have worried about chlorine damage. What she cared about was covering up the brown mark near her hairline that might have given away her identity, the mark she hid by rubbing her forehead the whole time I was looking at her. That rubber cap would have hidden it very effectively when she was out and about at the resort. It would also have drawn attention to her as the one doing things differently. In a pool full of uncovered hair, one girl wearing a bathing cap would stand out. Melody, who was officially dead, couldn't be allowed to attract attention in that way, so somebody came up with an ingenious idea. Reinvent her as Haley, the terminal cancer victim. Hope Katz might have been her fake name for room booking purposes, but around the resort, in the Art for Beginners class with Zelly Fry, Melody played the part of poor, tragic Haley, who always made sure to wear her flesh-coloured rubber skull, the one that made everyone believe she'd lost all her hair to chemotherapy. Wrap a scarf around her head so no one could see the join. Easy. The more I think about it, the more likely it seems. Haley, the cancer sufferer. It makes perfect sense. Mrs. McNair saw her around the resort and recognized her from the picture she'd seen online of Melody as she would look at 14. She knew Haley was Melody, but no one would listen to her because she'd previously said the same about lots of other children who weren't. When she saw Melody running at night, holding Poggy, she became even more convinced she was right. The words I overheard,
"How come she can run all of a sudden? Can my cousin Isaac run? Let me tell you, he can't even walk."
We're both confused and, at the same time, entirely logical. Mrs. McNair recognized not only Melody, but also the girl with cancer that she'd seen around the resort. And she knew enough from her cousin Isaac's lymphoma to know that terminally ill people generally aren't too good at running fast. She was trying to tell Rihanna she finally had proof that the girl she thought was Melody couldn't be who she claimed to be, because true terminal cancer sufferers don't sprint like healthy people. Long dark hair flying out behind her, Mrs. McNair told Rihanna. Why would she mention that unless she saw it as further proof that the girl calling herself Haley hadn't lost her hair, that it was all an act? The only problem with my theory is Taryn. I was with her in the club car when she went to pick up Zelly after art class. She was annoyed because she'd wanted a painting of Zelly's and Zelly had insisted on giving it to sick Haley instead. If Haley, Melody, escaped from Swallowtail in the small hours of my first night there, how can she still have been in the art class afterward to argue with Taryn over a painting?
No way she'd have gone back, too risky. Unless... Kara, what the fuck is going on with you?
I've made him angry by keeping my thoughts to myself. This is like Cousin Isaac all over again. Cousin Isaac only needed to be sick, but I assumed he was dead. Same with Haley and art class. Taryn never said Haley was there that day. She said, on the contrary, that Haley had taken a turn for the worst. That's why Zelly had been so intent on giving her the painting as a gift, because she was sicker than usual. That means she might have been absent from the class,